are listening to Yale Radio, WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with artist Mary Heilman. Mary, thank you so much for being on our show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, Mary, to begin with, I think many people already know your work and your history. Can you tell me a little bit about what you're working on now in the studio, what's exciting at the moment?
Interesting. Well, I've just come home from London where I have a show up, which I work very hard for the last 3 years. And so when I got back, I'm just sitting in the studio staring into space. And pretty soon I start thinking about what I'm going to do next, which is to take apart the ideas that are in the paintings that I've just finished and reconfigure them in new ways. And some of the ideas I'm going to make out of clay. So I'm going to take the imagery in the paintings, make them out of ceramic, and float them on the wall. So that's it. That's what I'm up to now.
Now, that's very interesting, because maybe we should go back to your early career now, because I know you did you start out as a ceramicist?
Yes, I did.
So why don't we talk a little bit about that? You went to school where?
Well, as an undergraduate, I was a literature major at Santa Barbara, University of California. Then I went up to Berkeley because I had started throwing pots in Santa Barbara as a hobby. Went to Berkeley to study ceramics with Peter Boulkes. Yeah.
And at that time, ceramics, I would think, was still struggling, or maybe it still is, as a fine art form, no?
We were working very hard to make it be to break down in physical and literal ways the practice of traditional pottery making. And some of the artists that were inspiring me were like Peter Boulkes, Kenneth Price, and Ron Nagel, among others. So, let's see. First you learn to throw pots, and you're really quite good craftsman, and then you deconstruct the pots to make sculpture.
And what was your first exhibit? Do you remember that?
When did I first have a show? Well, let me think. So that was in the early 60s. I finished at Berkeley, got the degree, and came to New York in 68. I think in 72, I had a show in New York at the Whitney Museum Independent Study Program. They had a site for shows.
Right, yeah. And that independent study program, that still exists, and that must have been a great program for you. I mean, that was kind of a launching pad for a lot of artists, I suppose.
Yeah, it was wonderful. I wasn't in it. They just asked me to do a show there, and this is, say, 1970-ish, and I did work that was a combination of sculpture, performance work, and something that was sort of going over to starting to look like painting.
And how did they choose you? How did that happen? I mean, that sounds wonderful, your first show.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was around there. I lived in Chinatown, and the Art Resources Program was right down the road at the end of East, on Cherry Street, really the way Lower East Side. And I went over there to see some of the artists who were working there, one of which was Julian Schnabel. So I guess maybe Julian asked me to come. And I looked at his, and then I met the people there, and then they asked me, Ron Clark, who I think is still there, asked me to do this.
So it was also, there was a community of artists building in New York.
Totally. And, in fact, the community aspect of being an artist is probably, for me, the most important part of it.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because that's very interesting. And, of course, what all artists are dealing with that are coming to New York is just that, like where to start, how to build support or get a community so that something like that happens. You're invited somewhere or things begin. How How did that happen? How did that community happen for you, or what do you think are the elements of that?
Well, you know, so I came from Berkeley to New York. The Richard Serra, who was in school with me in high school and at Santa Barbara, was here, and he helped me by introducing me to people. I got a loft on West Broadway, went to Max's Kansas City, and Smithson, Andre, Eva Hess, you know, I began to see all those people and get to know them.
It was very good in
New York because you could almost walk everywhere.
I mean, that sounds extraordinary. You know, I mean, you know, knowing all those artists then, I don't know what the equivalent of that would be now. That's, it seems, you know, almost hard to compare to now, but maybe it isn't that you're meeting these artists who all turned out to be, or many of which turned out to be major figures in the art world.
This was 68. They were really big already.
They were.
In 1968, yes. They had been showing in Europe, and one reason I was so excited to come here was to be a part of that gang. And Richard was already showing and doing a lot of doing some shows in Europe, getting some attention.
So how did you become part of that gang? What does that mean? How do you become part of that gang?
Oh, actually, I didn't become part of that gang. I wanted to, but it wasn't that easy.
Right. So let's talk about that. So that's what's interesting.
I went to Sorority Rush and I got rejected. I was really cocky and confident, and I had the kind of attitude that I just showed when I just said those things. And it really didn't work that way. For one thing, it was my attitude. Was the second thing, it was kind of a male-centered type of situation then. And a few women were part of it, such as Eva Hess, was really, really important. And so I was doing sculpture, which kind of fit in with what they were doing. And I still wanted to go to Max's and engage in the dialogue. So I started really transforming my work from sculpture over into painting. And I've talked about this before. Everybody, including me, hated painting. We thought it was totally over in 1968, even though I love the color field painters, but they just couldn't be a part of that discourse, so I didn't bring them up unless I wanted to have a fight with somebody like Robert Smithson.
Right.
So a big part of the discourse was that painting the second time since Duchamp was dead.
Mm-hmm.
So start making wall-based flat images, subjects, and then finally building a stretcher bar, a rough rickety stretcher bar by myself, and making something that was a painting. And then I started showing in a gallery in New York around 1972.
And which gallery was that?
That was called Paley & Lowe, and it was...
How did you get that show? How did that begin?
That happened through a friend of mine from graduate school. So, see, relational aesthetic, social discourse is very, very important in the way I went along. My friend met them, and then they liked my work. Jeff Paley and Jillian Lowe had this beautiful gallery on Worcester Street. And the gallery showed... Joan Snyder and Pat Steer. So it wasn't prejudice against women at all.
Hmm.
And this is 1972.
Because that was an issue you were constantly navigating then.
Yeah, it was significant. And actually, that was another important reason why I got into being an artist. 'Cause you could hang out with all the boys.
Hmm. But you're saying you were at the same time, though, you were excluded from that club, or
right? You
or
know,
that...
it's like being on the playground, and you go over and you say hi, and they all start playing kickball, and then you go around the other side of the field and say hello again, and it was a part of the dance, you know, and it ultimately worked out. It took 40 years, but.
Well, that's very interesting because in the span of your career, it took 40 years to get into that group, you mean? Is that what you're saying? Because I know this is, also the case, of course, with the artist Marilyn Mintner, who, her career also took off, quite a bit later. And she's also talked about that, even today, women artists can't reach the kind of, as she referred to it, kind of white hot status as Julian Schnabel or Damien Hirst.
Uh-huh.
Do you think that's true? Is there still
I don't feel it anymore. I feel she and I and a lot of us are equal to those guys. Yes.
Right.
So I have a different attitude. I go someplace and everybody says hi to me. Used to be
right.
Like if you'd go to a fancy party and nobody would say hi to you. So it's a beautiful thing. It's personal and psychological, but it's also cultural that we really are considered significant.
Right. And how was that? I mean, I think what's interesting is, as you said before, that the whole social paradigm of what's happening with an artist is so significant. How was that to struggle? It seems like you'd have to have a lot of strength to struggle through that in the early 70s and 60s. And, this not being included in the club, getting in there, I mean, 40 years later, that's happening. But what was the battle like then? How does an artist, or how did you at that time, keep pursuing it when in a sense there was a lot of closed doors? Where did you...
The work was really primary. So I had nice studio, three nice studios since I've been here. So I love the looking at the work, and it was convenient not to have that big of a gang because you'd have lots of time to stare at the work and figure out what to do next and to actually make the work. And there were a few people that I hung out with and had conversations with, but that really wasn't the priority. I was really a loner. And as the 70s went on, I lived in something that was like a hippie commune in Chinatown, a big loft full of people who were constantly cooking and having parties and listening to music. And I was on the top floor. And a lot of the time when everyone was partying downstairs, I was upstairs working. So it was a kind of a psychologically masochistic type of situation, but also I was really loved thinking and working and being alone. Yeah.
And did you have many studio visits then? Was that something you were good at getting? That's also an issue today with
right.
artists.
It kind of happened naturally, little by little, not too many. First I showed there with, and so I'm saying I'm a loner. That's a sort of a deep attitude of mine. But at the same
right.
time, Paley and Lowe closed, and then Holly Solomon showed up and opened her gallery, which is an incredible group of people. 112 Green Street was an artist venture in Soho. Now we're talking early 70s still. And early 70s for 112, later for Holly Solomon. A wonderful community of artists that I was a part of, except that I saw myself as a loner.
Can you tell me a little bit about that community of artists? That sounds interesting.
How
did they
great.
Operate?
That had Jeffrey Liu, who was the one that lived in 112 Green Street. His girlfriend was Kathy Bigelow, who was a student at Columbia at the time. Gordon Mata Clark had just come to New York from Cornell. Susan Rothenberg came to New York. I think she, not from Cornell, but she'd been there. Ned Smythe, Joan Jonas, Harriet Corman. So that's 112 Green I'm talking about. And it was a rough loft that did a lot of brilliant shows.
And as an artist group, how did you guys function together? You met, that was where a lot of discourse happened about work, or how did it
That's
really
right.
function?
It was there. They had a group which also included Richard Nonis, Mata Clark, and I can't remember some of the other people. Jeffrey Liu was important, and Alan Sarrett, and they had something they called an architecture, which was really radical because that's Mata Clark influence coming out of Cornell, where he studied architecture, and then his work, which is about architecture and about deconstructing architecture, and the conversations in the group were about that. Now, I was not a part of that. I just know about that. I'm hiding out in my studio being kind of crabby, and all of this other stuff is going on. So it impacted me, socially connected with me, but my role was the outsider. So that's kind of cool. I was inside and outside at the same time.
That is really cool. You know, if you don't mind, I'd like to talk about that even more. So within this group, because this is kind of an interesting, to me, paradigm of how artists, you know, build relationships and support within the culture, with other artists. So you're outside as well as inside. You're in this group. How did you know even what was happening in terms of the discourse of this group or the discussions they were having and things they were thinking if you were on the outside as well?
Mainly from going to the bars and clubs. And also the 112 Green Gang started this restaurant called Food. And so there were these different hangouts. Mickey Ruskin had Max's, and then there was the Ocean Club. There were clubs, bars, restaurants all around downtown where everyone hung out. We also went to openings in Soho, you know, and parties.
So that sounds like you were part of the discourse, but you weren't. What part, you know, in one way you say you're outside. How was it outside? What scenes were you not involved in?
Well, I guess it mostly sort of a philosophical attitude, like a way to have a conversation coming from a sort of negative argumentative point of view. But I was pretty much always there, but very critical and critically opinionated.
And so was that a problem? I mean, didn't other people also feel the same way, or did that make you stand out in the group?
Yes, that was kind of the style. A lot of people were like that. That was the way to do it. I think that's still going on in a way.
Yeah, I think so as well.
And it makes for good conversations. And then you have a conversation, an argument, almost a fight, and you keep going with it. And then sometimes there's a beautiful, there always, when it's interesting, is a powerful, beautiful truth and denouement.
Can you think of any particular scenario where that occurred?
I wonder.
I know that's a difficult question.
Yeah. So I'm working away all this time, little by little, becoming more civilized and acculturated about functioning as a part of a group and seeing that as a positive way to work rather than to always have an attitude of animosity. So I work all along, and then pretty soon, like, at the end of the whatever 90s, I do this survey show that travels around the country and ends up at the new museum. And so, like, a lot of people saw that. And they saw that this kind of what you would say is institutional critique-ish type of art, which was irritating a lot of people. You see it all together in one place, and a lot of people liked it that didn't like it before. So that was almost like, would it make a great play, actually.
Right. That's interesting. And how do you feel about, maybe you asked this before, but artists today are facing similar issues. But when you talked about this group and coming from different perspectives, was there also support within that group? That's something maybe you didn't hear then, but people talk about now. Artists kind of supporting and helping one another in getting shows or creating discourse. Was there also that kind of direct support, or would that word or concept not have been used so much then?
As Yes, there was. And the reason that the show happened, the traveling show happened, was through friends and people who were sympathetic to my work, talking to curators. And so the word was going around. There was this other part where, you know, there was a real positive conversation going on. So there's the powerful, contentious, negative attitude, and at the same time, there's the powerful, loving, accepting, productive attitude going on. And the negative and the positive were equally productive in making the discourse.
That's very interesting. So in conclusion, you know, artists are listening to this, and many artists are trying to make their way in the world in various ways with all kinds of mediums. And, you know, your story and a lot of what we've covered is very interesting in terms of how an artist begins to get out there into the world and become part of the conversation. Is there anything you want to say about how do you imagine artists can do that now, or what they should be looking for to help themselves?
Well, the art enterprise is huge global now, and so I always say to young artists to find a local community. Like someone is trying to get their work out in a show or something, I say start going to the openings of the galleries that you really like and try to get to know people there. And so it's similar, only a little bit more formalized when I say it that way. And so try to cultivate friendships with people you like and think locally, not globally. So you don't look at the whole art world and think, whoa. You look on around your shoulder and see who's your neighbor in Bensonhurst, you know?
Right, right. And in terms of artist groups, do you think artists should be forming those or looking for those? It sounds like such a wonderful situation you've been describing.
Yes, I do. I think like artists getting together and starting cooperative galleries, which is going on a lot nowadays, is fabulous. Wonderful way to work.
Yeah,
oh, and the other thing I always say that's really important is be sure you figure out some way to make a living so that you don't always have to be trying to sell your art.
Right. You mean having some form of an income that
right.
can support you.
Yeah.
And do you mind me asking, what were you doing in the beginning of your
career? I always taught, you see, the whole time I taught at universities, art schools. I taught for, like, almost the whole time, from the 70s, till just a few years ago at the School of Visual Arts. So that was a community, too. You see, you have the artists of each generation coming through the school.
Right, yeah.
You learn as much as when you teach, you learn as much as you teach.
Because of all the student work you're seeing and
yeah.
the discourse that's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mary, thank you so much for speaking with us today. I'm really grateful.
Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio, WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.